always enjoy coming to Dayton, although I must say I enjoy it much better when I'm parked out there looking this way instead of up here being responsible for the evening message. Want to compliment you on the appearance of your church. Your stairway looks real nice, and the continual efforts you're putting forth here to keep the building in shape. And, you know, many times we neglect to keep the house of the Lord, the place where we worship, as good as our homes. And it's important that we keep our places of worship as tidy and clean and place where we want to be and where we want to be to worship the Lord. I was wondering how Brother King was going to introduce me, because I had the pleasure of introducing him at Troy View, and I introduced him as a freckle-faced kid from Kentucky. But he did very well, and so I won't take this any farther, and we'll get on. Now, I'm not really going to call this a sermon. Brother Kane asked me, and I told him what I was going to speak about or give him an idea. I said, this is not going to be a sermon. It's going to be a talk. And if you people don't like it, the way it turned out, well, it's Brother Kane's fault. But it's like a boy, man, he was invited to speak to this church. And when he was finished, one of the young men in the congregation came up to him and he says, you're not a very good speaker. And one of the fellows overheard him, and he came up and he was trying to smooth things over, and he said, you'll have to overlook that young fellow. He said his dad is a charter member of the church here. He's very prominent in the town, and we just kind of overlooked that boy. He says the real trouble with that boy is he just goes around repeating what he hears other people say. Well, I don't want to take up too much of your time in telling stories this evening, but we'll get into what we want to talk about. And if you take a course in speaking, they tell you to talk about things that you're familiar with, things that you know about, and incidents that you're familiar with, and things that have happened to you. And so this evening I'd like to share some of the observations that I have made in different jobs and different committees I've served on and different positions I've had and the associations with people that I have been with. And I have found that many times it learns to listen. When I was on the staff at Wilmington College, we had a staff meeting one day, and I attended this meeting, and all these professors and doctors' degrees, and that was one day I didn't have much to say, because I realized that these people were way ahead of me in their discussion of current events and what was going on. And sometimes you realize that your opinion isn't always sought after by others, and that you're in the midst of other people who have much more to offer than you do, and it kind of comes as a shock to a young man in his 20s to find this out. But I think as we go along and listen to other people, this is one of the things that we fail to do. We do not listen. We're always thinking about what we're going to tell the other person, and we can't wait till they stop talking until we can get the chance to start telling them about ourselves. And so if you want a person to think you're a pretty nice fellow, just keep asking them questions about themselves, and the longer they talk, when they walk away from you, they say, boy, he's a wonderful guy, and because you gave them a chance to express and to talk about themselves. Now, the boys asked me what I was going to talk about, what the sermon title was this evening, and I said there's not really a title, but I guess we'll call it Economics of Christianity, or Rambling with Duane, whatever you want to go with. You know, the preacher, he was invited to speak to a Rotary meeting. You know, Rotary meetings, they only have a certain time for their meetings. It's very short because all these men are professionals and they have to be back to work, and they invited this preacher to speak one day to the Rotary meeting, and they couldn't get him stopped. And the chairman reached over and tugged on his coattail, and the preacher never paid any attention to him, so he thought, I'll take the gavel and I'll rap the table lightly, and I'll get this preacher slowed down, and which he did, and the preacher didn't pay any attention to him. So he said, well, I'll hit the table a lot harder, and he raised up his hand, and as he came down, the gavel flew out of his hand, hit this fellow in the front row right between the eyes, and it knocked him cold. In fact, they thought he was dead, and the fellow says, no, wait a minute, he's trying to say something. He leaned over, and he said, hit me again, I can still hear that guy talking. So today we're going to get into this thing and talk about the economics of agriculture and some of the things that you're going to think, well, I'm giving a talk on agriculture, but I'm going to tie these things together as prophecy and some of the things that are going to happen in the future. And so let's get started with some of the things that you hear about and you read in your papers, and you only get one side of this story. And the first thing we'll talk about is the Russian wheat deal. 2 weeks ago, I was at a meeting with where one of the men worked out this Russian wheat deal with these people that came from Russia, and when we went over there and sold them the wheat, and the Russians are coming over here. I think they're supposed to be here next week to buy more wheat, and so we explained some of the economics of this. Russia has had a drought for 2 years, and this last year they've had a real drought. They just have nothing but a dust bowl. And if you would imagine the southern part of Russia not being any farther south than St. Louis in this area, and most of their farming region equal to that in Canada, you get an idea pretty much of what type of agricultural environment that the people in Russia have to grow grain. And so they have this severe shortage of grain, and they are trying to deal with the United States. And at one time I knew the exact number of millions of bushel that was bought. But there's several things involved here. People started arguing about who's going to get the right to ship this. And the United States wanted part of this. You know, the American shipyards are very obsolete compared to other shipyards across the world. It's going to cost the American government $50 million in subsidies to ship their share of the wheat to Russia because of the obsolete methods we have in handling this wheat. But the this drought and this world condition, and China is also needing wheat and starting to buy this, and this has had buoyed up the wheat harvest, the wheat prices here in this country, and we're going to tie a few more of these things in together with this a little bit later. But to me, we talk about being in a land of surplus, and we have 1 year's supply of corn on hand in the United States, and we had a 3 year supply of wheat on hand. And to me, if you talk to all the agricultural economists, which I meet with several times, the last couple of years they've been talking about the thing of a world famine is way off. You know, we hear about the starving people in India, and they have developed the wheat in India that produces 100 bushels to the acre, and India is going to be self-sufficient in wheat production. But seeing here the changes, the drought that come about in Russia, and the demand that's made on the economy and the surpluses we have in the United States, that it wouldn't be but a very short time that world conditions could change very rapidly and we would have a shortage of food. Now we'll get back to this a little bit more. World supply, the United States supplies a great amount of feed. I don't know if you realize this or not, but one out of every 4 acres of corn produced in this country is exported. And nearly half of the acres of soybeans produced are exported. And one of the things that these countries that deal with us complain about is that our unions and our strikes that we have slow up the supply of this grain to different countries. And they want the United States to build storage bins all over the world so we can store our grain and wheat in it, so that when we have dock strikes, that these people can get to this food that we have in these different places. Now, we're all familiar with the increase in the cost of different food items we buy today. But we know, and from statistics, that 15% of the disposable income in the United States is spent for food. Compared in Russia, it's 50%. One farmer in America feeds himself and 52 other people. This allowed an industrial expansion in the United States because many people were freed from the chores of producing their own food and fiber. And what has resulted in this? We have people able to manufacture products that make living easier, more automated machines. We've also resulted in a higher income per person, disposable income, and it has also resulted in more leisure time that people do not know how to use this time today. Excuse me, I just lost a filling in my tooth, and this thing's giving me some trouble, so I had to do something with it, so I'll just take it out. Some of the things that happen to people is when they get up and try and talk. The meat supply, you've heard about meat quotas have been lifted in the United States. And this is an effort to lower the meat prices in the United States. Well, I'm going to tell you that it isn't going to lower the meat prices. Food prices are going to be higher. And to back up this a little bit, people in the world are getting a taste for meat products. In England, London, England, there's a restaurant that just opened up. It's called the Great American Disaster, and they serve hamburgers like we have here in the United States, and people line up for blocks to get a hamburger. And the people in Japan have developed a desire for beef. This last fall, a Japanese envoy came here in the state of Ohio, and they bought 5,000 feeder cattle in Ohio and Kentucky, and air freighted those back to Japan so that they can start raising their own beef. And so the exporters into this country, Australia, and these many countries can get more for their meat in Japan and England than they can in the United States, so there's not be much meat brought into the United States. But there's no area in the world like the Midwest. There's no productive area in the world that can produce corn, soybeans, and different fiber that we have here in this area. And I think when I think about the Russian wheat deal, you think about the land of Goshen, where the children of Israel were captive for 400 years, and it was a land of plenty and described as the ideal conditions and could grow all types of grain. And then Joseph and his brothers being sent there to him to purchase food. I sometimes think, is this the role the United States is going to play in a period of time? Now, we know in prophecy that there's scripture that there will be famines and droughts and pestilences in latter days, and we're having these things now, and I'm not going to sound like a preacher of doom. It's in the scriptures, and we'll get more scriptural reference a little later. But we today see many changes in agriculture and the different things. Now, many of us do not realize what efforts the government goes to regulate our economy and our lives. And there's a committee, it's called CED, a Committee on Economic Development, that tries to control the economy of the government. And it kind of got out of hand over a year ago when they put on price controls, phase one, two, and now three. But I was in a meeting in 1969 when the president of the Federal Reserve System laid out what they were going to do in the next 2 years to try and slow down the economy. And the things they did, they exactly did what they said they were going to do. One of their main things is they raise interest rates so high that people do not want to pay the interest, and this slows down spending. And this man in this meeting says the first people we're going to hurt are you farmers. The next people we're going to hurt is a small businessman, and then the small people that try and borrow money, and then this in turn will hurt the big people, and we'll get this slowed down. Well, it's exactly what happened. In fact, they almost had an overkill. In 1971, they turned around and put a lot more money back on the market. They lowered the interest rate, and the economy has taken off again. At this time, there's more money being saved in banks than any other time in the history of the United States. This may seem as surprising to you, but bankers today are trying to find places to invest their money. And they actually come to us wanting to know if we want to borrow money from them. And to prove this, we're borrowing money today at 6.75% interest. So we're seeing a big change. And one more thing about this environment today, we're talking about environmental control. They used to call this the Pollution Control Board, but pollution sounds like a bad word, so they changed this and they call it the environmental control. Well, you know, agriculture has been in a conservation business for years, and the production we have today is due to scientific discoveries. scientific know-how in the production of food. And if many of these things are lifted, we will have a severe shortage of food. And you may think, well, this fellow is just talking from a standpoint of a person who raises a lot of corn. But when we ready to put out corn, we have to put in an insecticide in the soil, and this kills the little worms that attack the corn. And if we do not use this insecticide, only 50% of the corn will grow. And so you could see if all these things come about, because of our environment, the people afraid we're going to destroy ourselves by the way we produce our food, that we are really going to create more havoc. And I think an example of this is the pollution control on automobiles. You buy a new car today, you get 7 or 8 miles a gallon of gas. Several years ago, it wasn't too hard to get 15 miles a gallon of gas. So what are they talking about today? We got a fuel shortage. We lifted imports on oil into this country, and we got a severe fuel shortage facing us. And so if all the environmentalists have their way, we're going to see quite a few changes in this country. You know, farmers that I talk to say we ought to quit farming for 1 year. And you see a lot of changes come about. So I am not knocking all these things as bad or good, but I'm saying that the technology to detect these different things has advanced far farther than what the tolerances are on these things. I'll give you one more example, and we'll go on to some other things, but I think this is necessary for a background. You heard that they removed diethyl stibestrol in the use of producing beef, and about all cattle feeders use diethyl stibestrol. It decreased the cost of putting on pounds of beef by 15%, and they said this was a cancer-producing organism, but they have never found any people that they have produced cancer in. They have in mice, but these mice were they would get cancer from almost anything. But this is the same hormone that they use in treating women in the menopause, and for a woman to get as much GES from eating liver as she does in one therapeutic dose, she would have to eat 7,000 pounds of raw liver at one time. And so we can see how obsolete and how ridiculous many of these things are. You know, today, if I told you this evening that 50,000 people are going to die this year from drunken drivers, you know, it doesn't save you one bit. But if I tell you 50,000 people are going to die from eating contaminated bananas, we all grab our throat and we wonder, is it me? And so this is how we think. We think about our stomach, but we don't worry about getting hit by a drunken driver. Well, many of these industrial revolution that we're talking about in agriculture have caused problems in the cities. One of the mayors of the large town, Cleveland, Ohio, said, "We don't have a city problem. We got a misplaced farm person's problem. Because of the productivity of farms, many people have left seeking other jobs. They crowded into the city, and we got problems." And so these are some of the things that lead up to the problems that we as churches today are trying to meet the needs of the people. And I think it's important we understand a little bit of their background and why they're there and some of the economic conditions that have put them there. And it's easier for us to understand their plight. Misplaced persons that have to be retrained. You know, in agriculture, it's a rule of thumb that outside factors affect your income more than the things you control yourself. And I think maybe after we finish here this evening, you'll realize that outside factors almost affect your lives more than the things that you have control over yourself. You think about that a little bit. Outside factors affect you more than what you have control over yourself. Today, we haven't spoken anything about crime or moral issues. And so we can see there's many things that upset the economy or affect people or cause them to think the way they do. We live in a time when of great tension and stress. and hurry and noise. I'm not telling you anything new, am I? We live in a time of stress. And you know, we hear people today that say, boy, I wish things could be just like the good old days. But I'm going to tell you something, there's not going to be anything like the good old days. Those days are gone and past. You're going to have to learn to live in the future. And this is one of the things that I've had to come to in the last few years, is to make up my mind that I have to learn how to live under stress, tension, hurry, and noise. And I think we are going to have to learn to live in this type of economy. Troy View, I've been teaching the adult Sunday school class to the older adults. And if you want to get a good discussion going, we'll talk about how things were in the good old days, and everybody chirps right in, you know. When you used to sit on your front porch and lock in a rocking chair, how long has it been since you've done that? And just rested. You know, I have a man working for me from Kentucky, and there's nothing wrong with this, but he's got a porch clear around the back of his house. We get done working in the evening. He eats his supper, and he goes out and sits on the porch and rocks and watches the cars go up and down the road. You know what Dwayne's doing? He's running here to that meeting and that meeting there. And the next morning, the hired hand's out to the barn a half hour before I am, and I'm out there, and I'm half tired, and he's ready to go. I just wonder sometimes who's smarter, him or me. And I'm paying him to do that. So we get caught up in this rat race, if you want to call it, but we don't realize how much tension, noise, and stress, and these things affect our bodies. And we handle a lot of cattle, nearly 1,500 head a year, and I do all of our own medical treatments. And one of the things I have to do is keep the animal still when I'm treating them. You cannot run an animal to the shoot. You cannot get in back of him and holler at him and make him run as fast as you can. He'll get there and stand there and pant, and he may drop dead. I don't think Elaine can chase her patients down the hall at the hospital either. But she knows that you have to keep people calm. And this is one of the first things they will teach you in first aid, is keep a person calm. So we long for the good old days, but Hebrews, the 13th chapter, and you was wondering when I was going to bring a verse of Scripture in here, I'll bet. But Hebrews, the 13th chapter, and the 5th verse, tells us to be content with such things as ye have. And Proverbs, the 24th chapter and the 19th verse, tells us to fret not. You know, I really like this word, fret not. Fret, to me, really displays a lot of tension, and a person just about ready to fly to pieces. But when I read the verse that just says fret not, to me that has a, you know, what would you call it? I was going to say sympathizing, but a stabilizing effect, that it just kind of calms your nerves. And people are saying today, they're attacking what we're doing today. And, you know, people today say we have to do away with Puritan ideas. They don't have the nerves enough to stand up and say we got to do away with the church and preachers. But they stand up and they say we have to do away with Puritan ideas. Well, when you think of a Puritan, what do you think about? Well, you think of a person in a black suit with a long tails and a black brim hat on, and you don't want to be associated with him either. And when they say we got to do away with Puritanism, that's what we're all attacking. When really you're attacking the principles of Christ, the teachings of the doctrine. And so today we hear many people saying we have to get rid of these Puritan ideas. But I think they're just attacking really the teachings of the Scriptures and the things that people have been taught to believe. Today we have many challenges of people attacking the things we're doing. But the Scriptures in Colossians 2:8 tells us, beware lest any man spoil you through deceit and vain philosophy. Today is a great time for philosophy. People sit around and they philosophize about how things are, and why are they this way, and why they should be, and what's wrong with the great society, and what caused this, and why am I this way. And today we have a lot of this philosophizing. Excuse me, it surprises me today. We think that we live in an intelligent time when people are wise and smart. But you know, we have more foolish cults and foolish religions today than we've had at any other time. We have people today with false doctrines in the churches that would make you laugh if you would listen to them. We had When we built the addition on our church, there was a Pentecostal preacher who did the drywalling, and he told me a friend of his was preaching, and he was preaching that the world was shaped like a hot dog, and the devil was in the inside just running back and forth from one end to the other, popping out wherever he wanted to cause trouble. And today people are teaching these things. I had a boy working for me that had a chain around his neck with a shrunken head of a monkey on his chain. It was a hideous looking thing. And I asked this boy what it was, and he said it was his guardian saint. And they prayed to this. They would clasp their hand to hold of this. And he wasn't allowed to eat meat, or he wasn't allowed to drink milk. This boy was 14 years old. He stood that high. All that boy needed was a good steak and a glass of milk. It would help him a lot. But people today, we have this with us today in 1973. People still going after these vain philosophies of what they are. And that's just a minor example of things today preaching. People are advocating today you don't need to get married. But God instituted marriage. And this is why he instituted one man and one woman. Think what a world this would be today for children growing up in a family without the stability of a home, without the stability of parents knowing they're going to stick together. It's bad enough with one out of every four now getting a divorce. But look at the uncertainty we would have if everybody had just lived as they pleased in this kind of condition. God knew what he was talking about when he told a man to have one wife. And so he knew the importance of having a stability in the home. That's just one example about these things. They encourage you to do different things if you would listen to them. You know, I often wonder how I appear to the non-Christian. Did you ever think about this when you walk down the street and you say, walk by somebody, and you ever wonder, what did that fellow think of me? You know, there's a scripture that tells us to abstain from all appearance of evil and so forth. And our dress, many times we dress the way we want to give the impression that we are. My brother who worked with juvenile delinquents for the state of Illinois asked him where they got many of the juveniles he dealt with, where they got the ideas for the things they did, and they said from the movies. He said, where did you get the ideas on how you're going to dress? They got those from the movies. They wore the jackets and so forth. And so what kind of impression do we make on other people? Now, I have friends that are German Baptists, and we talk about this because they wear their black clothing and they call it their black uniform, and we've talked about this, and I've asked them this question. I said, you know, they look at me and I look pretty much like a guy, any other guy coming down the street, but they look at you and how do they react? And I was surprised. They said a lot of times it's offensive. People try and make them mad. They resent their being like they are. But did you ever think what kind of impression that you made upon people as you passed them on the street, and what did they think of you? Are you influencing the Christian, putting out the Christian effort? Many times I think we fail to realize that we are the only connection that some people ever have with Christianity. They're the only connection they ever have with church. You're the only connection they ever have with a Christian. Or you're the only connection they ever have with God. And so we realize this is a great responsibility. One of the things I kind of, whenever we go to a farm meeting and they're going to have dinner, they ask for me to pray. And in a way, this is a compliment, but sometimes it's kind of funny when I go to the farm meetings, they call me the praying farmer. But in a way, it's a compliment. But still, there's people there that wouldn't pray that day if there wasn't some that did pray before their meals. And so we wonder what kind of impression we're making to other people. I have a friend that runs a grocery store near us. This man is an atheist. In fact, he told me, he said, well, you might call me an agnostic. But he said, this religion thing is just way out for me. Now, this man's a college graduate. He's in the insurance business. He says, let me tell you about some of the fellows from this church up towards town here that comes out here, and he's not talking about Troy View. He said, this fellow comes in, and he says, every night after Wednesday night after Bible study, these two guys come in about 5 minutes apart. And they'll come in, and he says, one guy says, give me one of those, and one of those, and one of those. He says, I can tell you what they're going to get every night. So they pay me, they walk out. Said, last week when I'm come in, says, give me that, and give me that, and give me that. are you coming to our special meeting? He says, I told him no. He says, why not? He says, I haven't been invited. He says, I just invited you. He said, did you call that an invitation? And he says, I would come to your church. You guys come in here. Is that Christianity? This is what he told us. And see, he told me this afterwards. He said, those guys are Christians. They come in here. They look like they're all uptight. They're growling with their kids. They're hollering at the wife out in the car. And they're trying to impress me with how good of a Christian they are up at their church. And so this is how a non-Christian looks at the Christian people. And so I think about this many times. Many times we treat people, what people do we treat the worst? The people in our family. We yell at them the loudest and treat them more rudely than we do people out in the world or people we're trying to impress. And so we have to remember what the things we do. We got to remember to be polite. You know, we live in a world today where you shove in a door. Boy, I hate to go shopping where there's a bunch of women. They'll just run over you. And you don't have a chance. And you try and be polite, boy, you didn't back out on the street. You just don't have a chance. Well, I just go back and come back some other day, I guess. But just little things about being courteous, to me, gives a sign of being a Christian. And someday I think we're all waiting for this great opportunity to rush out and save somebody from their sins. And the newspaper reporter is going to say, why did you do that? And you're going to say, because I'm a Christian. We're waiting for this big opportunity to prove our Christianity when we miss it many times each day. You know, we live in a money society today. You get up in the morning, you get your food out of a $300 refrigerator. You cook it on a $400 stove. You put on a $100 suit. You turn off the $500 TV, you go out and get in a $5,000 automobile, and you go worship in a $60,000 church. Now tell me that we don't live in a money society when things are geared by what they cost and the way we spend. But we're going to have to move on here, Rex, because I don't want to come back next Sunday and have to finish up like you did tonight. But I would come back, but I think I can get this done here in a little bit. You know, talking to a lot of people on these different boards, and I have a friend who's an owner of the Cincinnati Reds and the Bengals, and another fellow owns the Pittsburgh Pirates, and you get to know a lot of people and make a lot of connections, but you know, I found that many of these people are polite people. They don't try, you know, a millionaire told me once, he said, you know, when you got $1 million, you don't have to impress anybody. He says, it's the guy that's trying to impress you that you want to look out for. And this one fellow that he owns a big part in the Reds and the Bengals, has a home out by Urbana on a 5,000 acre farm. He invited 35 farmers there one night for supper. I was one of the group. Woody Hayes, the football coach at Ohio State, was a speaker for 35 people. They served food. They had mashed potatoes fixed up so fancy I didn't even know what they were. But I got to talking to John Sawyer. He found out he's a pretty religious man, and he saw a church in England that he liked real well, and out in his backyard he built a little duplicate of this church, and he has devotions out there every morning. And he goes out to this miniature church of a great church in England. It's built on a maybe 1/8 scale, and that's where he has his devotions each day. And so today we're living in a time when we look and let people impress us, but many times there's people that should impress us. A friend of mine called me up one day, and he knew about, I suppose I was one of the first people that talked to him about the second coming of Christ. He says, you know, my brother-in-law is getting all caught up on this, and he's going to speak down at our church this afternoon on the second coming of Christ. He says, I want you to come down. I said, all right, I'll be there. Well, you know, I thought, boy, I'm going to go down there and tell those people something about the second coming of Christ. I made a few notes on a 3x5 card and stuck it in my Bible in case I needed a few verses real quick. And this fellow, his brother-in-law, is a surgeon from Greenville, Ohio. And this man started talking about the second coming of Christ. And he felt that his life was full of activity that led him away from Christ. He says, I want you to listen to the things that happen to you. And he says, listen to the ads on TV and the things that we're told. You know, we're told today to enjoy ourselves. We owe it to ourselves to have a vacation. We owe it to ourselves to get a new model. If we don't have certain kind of foods in the refrigerator, we're just not too smart. And so he told about the different ways that we are enticed today. And I'm going to just give you an example to prove this. I took a course in sales psychology one time, and then I heard a man give this illustration. You know, when you see them advertise a car on TV, they don't show a man parked on 42nd Avenue in New York, waiting at the traffic light for the light to change, three cars across, and he's in a traffic jam. They just don't do this trying to sell cars. What do? They show him driving down a wide open country road. There's nobody else on the road but him, and this car goes over the bumps. He doesn't get flat tires, and all kinds of things happen. Now, when they sell cigarettes, what do? They don't show a person just smoking a cigarette and then have a coughing fit, do they? No, that this person's most generally sitting on a horse under a tree, and he's looking out at a bunch of cattle, and there's a stream flowing by, and it's just rained. It's springtime. And this is the way they sell. You know, people, we transfer. We relate to things like this. You know, sometimes I say, well, my boys are going to grow up doing what they want to. You know, all my boys look forward to the time they move to town and go down to the corner and buy a candy bar anytime they want to. But I think they'll get over this someday. But this man pointed out to me, he says, you know, you people that are living in the farm have a lot of things that people, other people look to and they want. He said, I want you to imagine the woman that looks at this ad on TV, and she's going to the grocery store, and she backs her sports car out of this condominium out on a four-lane highway. She drives 6 miles on superhighways to get to her favorite supermarket. She stands in line. She finally gets what she wants, and she gets her favorite pack of cigarettes. She gets out in the car, and she opens up one, and she opens it up, and she takes a puff on her cigarette, and she gets just about that much of what you've got. She's transferring herself out sitting on this horse looking at the cattle with a stream running by where it's just rained. And so today we transfer. This is the way advertising appeals to you. This is really a million-dollar industry of psychology and sales. And so if you don't think those things are enticing for your time and leading and bidding for your money, you're badly mistaken. Well, I want to get back to this doctor. He said that we owe it to ourselves. So you know what this fellow did, this doctor? I talked to a nurse that was in his hospital, and this fellow is one of the top-notch surgeons in the country. And this man, because he felt that his actions, the things that he was involved in, was leading him away from Christ, first thing he did is he gave away his TV set. He sold his house, he sold his farm, he sold his car, and he took this money, a lot of it, bought medicine to send it to India. He quit preaching. He quit being a physician, and he moved to Florida. And that's the last I caught up with him. He's still down there resting, I guess, now. But he was so convicted in his heart that the things he was doing was leading him away from Christ that he got away from these things. He attacked the medical profession. He told how many of the operations he performed were not necessary, but he could get $900 for 20-minute surgery and put you through a lot of discomfort, but he had $900 in his pocket, and he could walk out of there. He was telling many things like this. But he just felt caught up in this type of thing, and he felt these things were leading him away, and so that he actually quit his practice, sold the things he had, and gave his money to the poor. And so he prayed that God would reveal to him different teachings in the Bible. And I know I'm running just a little bit late, but I think this is interesting and you'll want to hear. If you turn to Revelation, the ninth chapter, and I want to present this as what this man said. I'm not presenting this as a true revelation of what's in Revelation. The brother Cain and I talked about this, and he thought it was interesting, and I'd like to just show it on to you. He prayed that God would reveal things to him in the ninth chapter of Revelation. He said he would go to bed at night, and he would have these dreams, and the next morning he'd wake up, and it was just like he had a dream, and this was revealed to him. And I'm not knocking what the man's saying, or I'm not trying to sell you on the idea of what he's saying. I'm just throwing the idea out, and you think about it. And he's talking here in the last days, in the seventh verse, and the shapes of the locusts were like unto horses prepared unto battle. On their heads were as were like crowns like gold, and their faces were as the faces of men, and they had hair as the hair of women, and their teeth were as the teeth of lions, and they had breastplates that were breastplates of iron, and the sound of the wing was as the sound of chariots of many horses running to battle. What do you think he was talking about here? Well, he was talking about today, the modern day helicopter. He says, you look at it, and it says that it had heads were crowns of gold, and their faces were as the faces of men. He said, today we have men in the helicopters, they got helmets on, they have long hair, and they made a sound as many locusts. And he said, this is descriptive of the helicopter that we have today. It's also shaped as a scorpion, and it has a tail on it. So I thought you'd find this interesting. Also in the 9th chapter, in the 17th and 19th verses, he's describing here that he saw horses in a vision, and the heads of the horses were as heads of lions, and let's go down to the 19th verse. For their power is in their mouth and in their tails, for their tails were like serpents and had heads, and with them that do hurt. What is he talking about here? The modern day automobile. He says you raise up the hood on the automobile today and what comes out? All kinds of fumes, sulfur, and all these things in the air. He says the scripture says they'll have tails like serpent heads. And if you follow some of the modern day cars down the road, maybe you will think they're a serpent's head. Now, this is just it's an interesting observation to me. And you look at these things, and he talks about the pit, the fiery pit and so forth. He said this is an American city today with the smog and so forth that we have coming off of it. So this is how Dr. Whaley reacted to his convictions about Christ's teachings. Did he do the right thing? That's up for you to answer. But the important thing is to know how we react to the teaching of Christ that is important. So in closing, I'd like to read one verse in Psalms 31:24. Be of good courage, and he shall strengthen your heart, and ye all ye that hope in the Lord. Thank you.